What is the one thing people do in life that they don't do for the sake of anything else? I mean, what's the one thing you do only for itself and nothing else? The answer to that is quite interesting, and it has a very important meaning in terms of how we ultimately live our life. The fact is, I have very logical reasons for believing in things that logic and reason cannot teach me. It's kind of ironic, but the more complexity science finds in life, the more unlikely becomes the whole scenario and theory they use to explain the origins of life. The amazing thing that quantum physics shows is that nature, at its most fundamental level, strains human credulity and belief in ways that biblical faith never does. Hi, Cliff Goldston here. Welcome back to the program. This is my 13th lecture so far in a series called Philosophy and Faith, in which we're taking a survey of Western philosophical thought, but looking at it from the perspective of faith. Now, we're still a few hundred years before Christ, now with Aristotle, with whom I want to finish with this talk. So once we get done with him, things do tend to move a bit quicker into the future. But for that period of a few hundred years in the ancient world, mostly Greek world, we had this very fertile and rich time as far as the history of philosophy is concerned, at least as the term philosophy is classically understood. You know, as I had stated in the first lecture of this series, you know, we all do philosophy, whether we think we're doing it or not. To renounce philosophy, to call it nonsense, as many have done and still do, and not without some good reason either, that's still to do philosophy. You can't get away from it. Anyway, back to Aristotle, and probably one of the greatest mortal minds that ever existed. The span of this man's knowledge, or I guess instead of saying knowledge, maybe I should say thought, was phenomenal. I don't necessarily want to call it knowledge because, well, after all, so much of what he taught was wrong, so it's really not knowledge. In fact, I think Aristotle probably helped the intellectual thinking of Western civilization, especially the church, which for a long time was the center of intellectual thought. I think Aristotle set it off in the wrong direction for centuries. See, the issue with Aristotle isn't so much what he taught, but it was his influence. That was astonishing. Anyway, I want to begin with a story. You might have heard it before. A wealthy man happens to be walking along a beach, and he sees a rather impoverished fisherman sitting on the beach, lolling on there, really doing nothing, soaking up the sun, having a drink or two, relaxing. Maybe his kids or his grandchildren come by, and he takes the time to play with them a little bit, you know, just taking it easy. He's quite poor, but he doesn't seem too concerned about being poor. He's enjoying his leisure time. Well, the rich man strikes up a conversation with this poor guy and asks him, "Hey man, why aren't you working? Why aren't you working harder? What are you doing with your life? Why don't you do more instead of just wasting your time sitting here on the beach, cooling your heels, doing squat?" Well, the poor man looks up at him, maybe shielding his eyes from the sun, tells him to have a seat. Maybe he handed him a cold drink, starts asking him a question. "You say that I should work harder, right?" "Yes," says the rich man. "Why?" asks the poor man. "So that you can have more money. That's why. What else?" "Okay," says the poor man. "So I work harder, earn more money. Okay, that's fine. Why else? Then what?" "Then what? What do you mean, then what?" the rich man says. "I mean, you work harder and then you earn more money, and then what?" Well, the rich man says, "Well, you can build a nice home, go places, have money for retirement. You can then do all sorts of things." "Well, like what kind of things?" the man asks. Well, like relaxing on the beach. Yes, things like that, the rich man says, relaxing on the beach. And the poor man says, precisely, who continues to relax on the beach and play with his children. Think about it. Now, that's a cute story. It's made the rounds. And maybe you agree with the moral of it, maybe not. It does, though, raise an interesting point, a point that Aristotle himself brought up, a point that even to this day still holds a fair amount of contention. And that has to deal with the question of teleology, the question of purpose. What is the end goal of a thing? What is the reason for something, be it an action, a physical entity, or both together? What is the ultimate purpose of it? What is the goal? You know, in many ways, this is such a logical, rational, even commonsensical way to look at our lives, to look at the world, and to seek to discover meaning from it. What is the ultimate meaning and purpose of our lives? You know, it's too bad, as I said in an earlier talk on Aristotle, that this teleology, this sense of purpose, has been lost in the modern world. I mean, you know, if you ultimately accept the rational atheistic evolutionary paradigm, which traces our origins and existence to a series of accidents, then quite logically, one wouldn't look for an end purpose, a terminus ad quem, an end point to which we're all heading, because in that thinking, there is none. I mean, that's what their thinking is. But there is an end point, isn't there? But it's just, in that thinking, they say there is an end point, but it's just as fortuitous and meaningless as the beginning point. That is, at least if you buy into that understanding of an existence, of our existence. I mean, there is an end, but don't look for it to have any more purpose. How could there be if everything about us is purely an accident of nature? Maybe there is some meaning, but it's hard to see how, at least how there could be any kind of meaning in anything we could be certain and firm about, that in a world in which we're told nothing has any meaning. However, if we look at this question of teleology in a little more narrow sense, then I think regardless of one's grand Weltanschauung, one's grand worldview about beginnings and endings, the issue becomes somewhat more relevant, though I'm really not sure if much of anything White say or has means much of anything if the overarching background and foundation of our existence is meaningless itself. Anyway, back to Aristotle and the question of teleology, or purpose. Think about this for a moment. You want good health, right? Why? Why do you want good health? Well, for among other things, you want to be able to work, right? Okay, so you want to work. Fine. Why do you want to work? Well, I want to work because I need the money. Okay, well, we all need money. But what do we need money for? I mean, money isn't an end in itself, is it? I mean, you can't eat it. You can't use it for fuel. I guess you could, but you wouldn't want to. You can't build a house with it. Of course not. No, money is used for an end. What is that end? Well, you can buy things. Okay, you buy things, and then what? You like the things. Okay, that's nice. You use money, you buy things, and you like the things. But then what? What is the purpose of the things? What do they ultimately do for you? Look at it like this. How many things do you do that are an end in themselves? That is what you do. That is what do you do that is not for the sake of something else other than the act itself? That is, there is nothing beyond them. What do I mean by this? Well, let's flesh this out a little more. That's kind of a pun, as you'll see. Okay, Americans. I'm an American. I live in America. And anybody knows Americans, they like to eat. I mean, just look at them, okay? But do they eat just for the sake of eating? Does anyone eat just for the sake of eating? I remember I knew a woman one time. She was a bundle of nerves. I remember, you know, us being in a van in Canada. She was bringing her life savings into a bank in Canada to flee the political oppression or something like that that she thought was coming in America. And I'm the one that I end up driving the van over the border with all the loot in there. I had no idea. She didn't tell me she had it all in there. She told me we were going fishing. Anyway, here we are. We're going to the bank the next day. And we're having trouble finding a parking spot at the bank because she told me she wanted to go to the bank. She said, we'll go to the bank, then we're going to go fishing. Okay. Well, anyway, we couldn't find a parking spot, and she starts having this fit, all this over parking. And only, you know, it's only afterwards when I saw all the gold and coins and jewels that they wanted to bring me in the bank, that they wanted me. I had to cart this stuff into the bank. Only then did I see why she was upset. This was her life savings, whatever. But anyway, at the point when we couldn't find a parking spot, she was screaming at everyone, and all the time she's screaming, she's stuffing food in her mouth. Now, this was a rather tense situation, as you could imagine. But the point is, she wasn't eating just for the sake of eating. She was eating to calm her nerves, to make herself feel better. Now, not everyone might eat for that reason, and we might really enjoy eating, but in the end, we eat to live. We eat to stay alive. Eating is something we do, quote, for the sake of something else. Most things in life are like this. Most things in life, we do have a purpose, a goal beyond themselves, something for the sake of something else, okay? Now, the question is, what is the one thing that we strive for that is never for the sake of anything else? I mean, you want to maybe make yourself look good, you know, because you like how you look or because you want to attract someone to you. You might want to get a graduate degree, you know, you want to get a certain job, so you get a graduate degree in order to get it. Whatever. Think about it. You often do things for something else. But according to Aristotle, there is one thing that we don't do for any other purpose than itself, and that is to be happy. Happy. You can say, I eat a lot of fruit because I want to be healthy. But do you say, I want to be happy because of blah, 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 blah? I want to be happy for the sake of and go to something else. No, happiness is really, at least as Aristotle says, the end of the line. It's not something that we do for the sake of anything else. It's an end in itself, the summum bonum. Here's Aristotle. Hence, Aristotle has been called a eudaimonist, from the Greek word often translated happiness, though that does not really do it full justice, as we'll see. This word lends itself to various interpretations, and if we're not careful, we can draw the wrong conclusion about what Aristotle himself meant by that, but we'll get to that shortly. But now, really, in a painfully commonsensical way, Aristotle makes a good point here. Think about it. What do you want to be happy for other than for the sake of being happy? You are not happy in order to achieve something else beyond it. It's the end point, the ultimate thing, according to Aristotle, that we seek to obtain. I mean, let's take for a moment the late Mother Teresa, okay, the apparent paragon of Christian service and selflessness, supposedly. Now, I don't want to take away for any moment from anything that Mother Teresa did or question her motives or anything like that. But let me humbly and fearfully ask, did Mother Teresa do what she did because she hated it or because it gave her a great sense of personal satisfaction, even happiness? Think about it. You know, I read an article in the New Yorker about best-selling novels in China. And the funny thing is that unlike in the West, where they say if you want to sell a book in the West, make it about sex. In China, the bestsellers are all about people making money, about people getting rich. I mean, the books have titles like Du Lao's Promotion Diary, as in getting a promotion at work, or Hecky Beejee's Beijing Success Diary, or Su Chengang's Struggle to Get a Raise Diary. I mean, that's very bizarre, but, you know, but from my perspective, but I'm a North American. Anyway, one of these books is about a young man who struggles to get rich and who decides to marry his college sweetheart. His parents are opposed to the match until they, her parents rather, are opposed to the match until they visit his 1,400 square foot apartment with two bathrooms. Okay, now the book has this climactic scene. The man tells his fiance that their wife, that whatever, that they'll buy a house and spend a lot of money to rejuvenate it. And she answers, "We should buy a full set of home appliances, a DVD player, a 29-inch television set, an automatic washing machine, an air conditioner, and a complete set of wooden floors." And then the author writes, "And so the door to happiness opened. Thus, the air conditioner and the washing machine, they weren't ends in themselves. They were means to an end. And that end was, as Aristotle said, happiness." Though I don't think his concept of happiness would have necessarily necessitated washing machines and air conditioners, at least not fully. Let me quote you from Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, because this helps explain what he means. "Every art and every inquiry, and similarly every action and pursuit, is though aimed at some good, and for this reason the good has been declared to be that at which all things aim." Notice this concept of teleology here, of a goal. Everything was working towards a goal. Then he goes on and says, "If then there is some end of things that we do, which we desire for its own sake, everything else being desired for the sake of this, and if we do not choose everything for the sake of something else, clearly this must be the good and chief good. Will not the knowledge of it then have a great influence on life?" What is he saying? He's saying, in other words, the end goal, that's which we strive for, that there must be something else, you know, there must be something that it stops at, there must be something, or else we would go on and on and on, infinitely never finding our purpose, the end purpose for which all our strivings are for. And that's the end point of everything. And again, really, that's quite logical. If you think about it, there's got to be something that ultimately we stop at. Let me read you some more. "Since all knowledge and every pursuit aims at some good, what do we take to be the end of all political science? What is the highest of all practical good? Well, so far as the name goes, there is a pretty general agreement. It is happiness," says both ordinary and cultured people. He also writes this, and this is the crucial point. "For we choose happiness as an end in itself and never for the sake of something else." Now that sounds so simple, so trite, and yet it's really quite profound. It's the end, and everything else is the means to get to that end. Now, as I said, the translation happiness can be somewhat misleading. He doesn't have a shallow view of happiness. It's not pleasure per se. You know, it's not just partying and getting high and having a good time. Remember that song years ago, "Don't Worry, Be Happy"? He views people who live like that as living lives worthy of cattle or the like. That's not what Aristotle is talking about. On the contrary, he takes a much more rational and logical approach to his understanding of happiness, which, you know, if you think about it, is kind of strange, because we don't often think of logic and reason as the precursors to happiness. Logic and reason seem so cold, so formal, in contrast to something soft and fuzzy like happiness. Here, though, is where it gets, where we have to look at the term. It could better be translated perhaps as thriving or flourishing. It's not a rush or gleeful moment of exuberance, which could easily be drug-induced. You know, read account of someone who snorts a line of cocaine, and they can describe happiness and euphoria that follows each sniffle. It's not being on the upside of manic depression either. These might be happiness in the short term, but it's not eudaimonia or thriving or flourishing as Aristotle taught it. What then is this thriving or flourishing that Aristotle thinks is the ultimate purpose? Remember here, we're dealing with ends, or I should say the end and the means to get there. Well, for Aristotle, what makes us distinctly human is the fact that we are rational creatures, that we were made to live rationally, that this is the distinctive trait that sets us apart from all other creatures. You know, in a sense, you could say that the final goal, the end goal, what he would say, of human existence is to live as rationally as possible. And this kind of life will lead to eudaimonia, or a thriving. Thus, whether you agree or not, Aristotle argues that the end goal of a human being is to live rationally. And this means to him living a virtuous life. It means following what he calls the golden mean, the balance of activity so we can live our life to the fullest in the most complete way. It means having an active part in the community. It means having friends. It means developing the right habits. So on, eudaimonia isn't just what a person feels. It's what a person does. It's the whole trajectory of a person's life. It's something to strive for, something we work at. To pull it from another context, you could say that this is the work of a lifetime. Here's how we describe, in a sense, what this life is like. He says, hence, it is no easy task to be good. Okay, notice, for him, it's to be good. For in everything, it's no easy task to find the middle. For example, to find the middle of a circle, it is not easy for everyone, but for him who knows. So too can anyone get angry. That is easy. Or to give or to spend money. But to do this to the right person, to the right extent, at the right time, with the right motive, in the right way, this is not for anyone, everyone, nor is it easy. You see, it sounds good, sounds reasonable, and it's good as far as it goes. But you know something? It doesn't go far enough, which is kind of ironic for a philosophy built on achieving what we call the summum bonum, the ultimate good, the final end. And here's why I think, however good and however reasonable what he's saying, it doesn't go far enough. And here's why. You know, for starters, Aristotle's philosophy here is really, as most of his philosophy, it's very humanistic. He brings it right down to the earth, to flesh and blood. That's quite a departure from his famous teacher, Plato, who was much more, well, for lack of a better term, otherworldly, up in the world of the forms and so on. Aristotle's ethics are rooted in what he deems human nature, in humanity itself, in human needs, in human goals. But see, that's all very contingent and fleeting and changing, are they not? Everybody wants to thrive, but not everyone will have the same concept of what it means to thrive. Let's just assume that people want to be virtuous, but maybe not everyone or even every society has the same concept of what it means to be virtuous. And then there's his famous golden mean, which we talked about striving to find the right balance in life. Well, that's fine in principle, but that's not some eternal mathematical formula that tells you what the right balance is. In fact, it's quite arbitrary and contingent. Some cultures think it virtuous when you're shamed to kill yourself, commit seppuku, I think that's how they pronounce it, seppuku, ritual suicide. Others would find that acting shameful. The point is, ultimately, however rational Aristotle's ethics might seem, they're based in human concepts, human thoughts, human ideas, and ironically, they're very subjective and contingent. They're not rooted in something that transcends the human. And thus, I would argue Aristotle's whole ethics here, his whole understanding here, is built on very shaky ground. You know, and that's where I think the ultimate fallacy is. You know, in the next point, you know, let's play his game of teleology a little further. When you did things for something else, and you did that for something else, unless you stopped somewhere, it would go on and on forever. And logically, Aristotle would stop at happiness. That's where he wanted to stop. Okay, fine. We do such and such, and we do on and on and on, and finally we achieve eudaimonia. We achieve what I would maybe call Aristotle's rationalistic nirvana. And we are, quote, happy. And I don't mean that in a derogatory way, in a mocking way. I mean that in the full highest sense that Aristotle meant it. Okay, we achieve eudaimonia. We achieve this rationalistic nirvana. We are happy. Great. I hope people can be happy. But then I ask, and then what? I mean, you're happy? Great. And you're living a thriving and happy and full life? Great. But where does that lead you? Where do you wind up? Hey, you wind up in the same place as the low-life scoundrel pedophile who lived down the street from you. You wind up dead. The ultimate end, if you really want to play that game, that Aristotle looking at the ultimate end is 6 feet under with tulips growing out of your plot. I mean, if you're going to try to derive, as Aristotle did, truth from what's around us, then one can argue rationally, with the added help of a little empiricism, that the ultimate goal, the ultimate end of life is death, because that's where it all winds up. Talk about a terminus ad quem. Thus, an ethical life is fine. And living by Aristotle's standards would, I suppose, mean a better life here for some people. Though this ethics doesn't really give, as if you read him, he doesn't seem to have any concern about slavery, which he happened to justify on rational grounds as well. The point is, Aristotle was brilliant, Aristotle was influential, but in so many ways he was wrong. His ethics dealt only with the symptoms, but he had ultimately no cure, no answer for what we get out of life, for what the real meaning of life. And the most we could get from him is thriving, rational, dead men walking. There's got to be more.